So John chapter 19, verses 1 through 16. And picking up where we left off from last week, we had found that the religious leaders had successfully manipulated the crowd. And just when it was needed the most, the voices of the masses were joined with the priests and the leaders in their cry, "Not this man, but Barabbas." And this takes us to John 19. Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. We know that Pilate wanted to release Jesus. But the harder he tried, the louder the objections. So he thought, if I scourge this man and spill his blood, just maybe it will pacify the lusts of these religious leaders and this unruly crowd. We know this because Luke 23, 16 tells us that Pilate had every intention of releasing Jesus after the scourging. Now you have to understand that this was no insignificant punishment. Roman scourging was terribly brutal, and the bloodletting effusive. In fact, many victims did not even survive the scourging to make the journey to the cross. So you have to understand that some serious blood was about to be spilled. And Pilate hoped, he just hoped that it would be enough. Before we talk a little bit about the brutality of the scourging, I want you to also be aware that on that particular, morning, on that particular day, Jesus' skin would have been extremely sensitive. And that would have increased the intensity of the Roman whip. We were told in Luke 22, 44, that as Jesus was praying in the garden, his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. This is actually a rare but well-known medical condition called hematidrosis. And the condition becomes hyper during times of immense psychological stress, situations which provoke anxiety. And what happens is it causes this release of chemicals which break down the capillaries inside the sweat glands. And as a result, there's a small amount of blood that just is released into these glands and comes out along with the sweat. And the effect on the body is that it gets extremely weak, very sensitive to all the skin because of that chemical that's being released. It also creates sometimes extreme, but often just moderate hydration issues from this, just the anxiety and the loss of the sweat and the blood. So Jesus would have already been in a state of physical weakness even before the scourging began. And then you have to consider that he was up all night. He didn't sleep at all. They had arrested him in the middle of the night and dragged him through this whole parade, probably without water and without any food. The man was physically weak. Now the purpose of the Roman scourging was to bring a person as close to death as possible without actually killing them. And that was the art of the Roman whip. As such, this punishment is often referred to as the half death. And there would be a team of between 1 and 6 specially trained officers called lictors. And they were responsible for dispensing these blows. These were medically trained people. And they had the specific training to know how to wield the whip to both bruise and then rupture the bruises that were already created, and yet know when it's enough. The lictors would strip their victim of their clothing, stretch their arms around a post with hands tied above their heads so that the victim's back was fully exposed. The whip used by the lictors would have been a short whip made of braided leather thongs of variable length. And the thongs would have metal balls and pieces of sharp sheep bone, usually, just sewn and woven into them. The metal balls were for bruising, and the sharp pieces of bone were for cutting and tearing. Sometimes the whip even had a hook attached at the end of the thong, and it was maliciously nicknamed the scorpion. The lictors, with full force, would repeatedly strike the victim's back, buttocks, and torso, causing deep contusions. And lacerations from the repeated blows cut into their underlying muscles and rip the overlaying skin of the back to a point where it hangs in ribbons of bleeding flesh. The capillaries and veins were often torn, causing intense bleeding, and at times leaving the entrails exposed. Even once the victim fainted, if the lectors could feel a pulse or detect sufficient respiration, the beating would continue. Once the centurion in charge determined that the prisoner is near death, the beating would be halted. There's a misnomer that's out there that Jesus had 39 lashes. It's not stated in the Bible. The Jews lashed people 39 times because it was stated in the law that no more than 40, so they subtracted one to make sure they didn't mess it up. This was a Roman scourging, not a Jewish scourging. There is no limitations. They beat him until he was that close to death. Listen closely to the following account I found of Jesus' scourging. Jesus stripped of his clothing, his back, buttocks, and legs exposed, his face against the upright post, hands tied above his head, is now considered prime, and the flogging can begin. The soldier comes forward, his gaze fixed upon Jesus, who is silent and appears to be in deep contemplation as he awaits the punishment. The soldier takes a step back and raises the whip over his head in preparation for the first blow. A whistling and cracking sound can be heard as the whip with its metal and bone tips is released with all the force the soldier has. The whip lands on the naked back, sending waves of pain coursing through the body. The legionnaires, having no restraint, appear to be in a satanic frenzy. They lash out with the whip, full force, again and again across Jesus' shoulders, back, buttocks, and legs. At each stroke of the whip, a painful shudder can be seen as waves of never-ending pain shoot through his body. His back is now a mass of livid marks, and blue and purple bruises show beneath the skin. The mass of observers attending the flogging who had condemned Jesus to death stood by cheering, shouting encouragement to the legionnaires, taking pleasure in the spectacle before them. Their delight obvious as the flesh is stripped from the body. Encouraged by the crowds, the blows continue, cutting deeper and deeper into the tissues. Blood begins to ooze from capillaries and veins of the skin until finally arterial bleeding from vessels and the underlying muscles occurs. The blood pours out. Shreds of skin become detached, hanging in ribbons. The entire area of Jesus' back has become an unrecognizable mass of torn flesh. Deep grooves caused by the iron balls exposing a bloody mass of muscle, bone, and tissue. Blood flows freely down his body, forming a deep red pool at his feet and surrounding area. His whole body trembles and shivers running down his spine as his strength begins to fail. His wrists being tied is the only reason he is still upright, because his legs have now lost the strength to hold him. Finally, it is over. Jesus is untied and collapses to the ground. Too weak to move, he stays there on the pavement, which is wet with his own blood. Imagine this whole ordeal was chosen for Jesus by his own Father. It was prophesied about some 700 to 800 years in advance, in detail. Isaiah 56, I gave my back to those who strike me, and my cheeks to those who pluck out my beard. I did not cover my face from humiliation and spitting. Isaiah 52, 13 through 14, behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted, as many were astonished at you. His appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. Honestly, I get so annoyed whenever I see depictions of Jesus on the cross, and he is shown with basically these little cuts and scratches on his back and sides, and maybe some ribbons of blood flowing down from these wounds. I mean, give me a break. These images may protect our sensibilities, but they do nothing to capture for us or portray for us what really happened and the damage that was done to our Lord. Look what it says. It says that his appearance was so marred that he did not even look human. He must have literally looked like a mass of just bloody, shredded meat. This was the Father's plan. John 19, 2 through 3. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. This scripture to me is so scary. It is so dark. I mean, it reveals the evil depravity of mankind. I cannot even imagine that men could be so dead within their souls that these legionaries had just beat Jesus within a breath of his life, and yet they take the time to mock him and ridicule him. It's entirely unbelievable. A crown of thorns, a purple robe, strikes to the face, and homage, all given as a symbol of Jesus' humiliating demise. To hit a man who is broken and disfigured is not just cruel, it's sick and depraved. I mean, what joy could have been found in it? I mean, what an atrocity. It's hard to believe the scorn that exists and can pour forth from the dark heart of humanity. John makes a point of telling us that they gave Jesus a purple robe. Not a robe, a purple robe, a detail not to be ignored. Purple was the color of the imperial elite, as it was the most expensive of dyes. And princes and just regional rulers donned themselves in this color. And yet it was given to this one that they hailed as King of the Jews. Hail! A homage typically reserved for their imperial leader, Hail Caesar. It was a way of saying to the crowd and those who are watching that their so-called king is nothing compared to the true king of Rome. It was a cut down or an indictment against all these people who had been gathered and saying, look, you're nothing compared to us. Then the crown of thorns. You ever thought about that? Why a crown of thorns? Again, he gives us the detail. Don't skip over it. You know what? It might just ironically represent the curse. The curse of sin. The curse that would soon be placed on Jesus as he would become sin itself. This King of Kings, who has faced unbelievable mocking, humiliation, and degradation, was crowned with thorns. Right? This was the symbol of sin that the Lord chose to be a persistent reminder of man's fall and his exile from the garden of evil. What did God say? You will have to work the ground and it would be infested with thorns. Genesis 3:18. There's also a twisted irony in the fact that they made him a crown. And in fact, the Greek uses the word stephanos, which means crowned. And during this time, only the highest ruler ever got to wear a crown. All the regional rulers, all these governors, all these prefects, all these senators, all they got to wear were wreaths. You've seen the pictures. Little did they know that this man was the true King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and the only one worthy to be wearing any kind of crown at all. John 19:4 through 5. Pilate went out again to see them. See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him. So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Remember, the Jews had refused to enter the judgment hall because they didn't want to defile themselves. So all this took place where Pilate was, inside. So he once again comes out to address them and brings with him this disfigured man adorned in draping of ridicule. And Pilate now, for the second time, proclaims Jesus' innocence. And in his statement, "Behold the man," it's as if he's saying, you know, this misguided martyr has suffered enough. And now, even mighty Rome must have pity on this man who simply does not deserve such treatment. And he wanted the Jews to recognize the injustice that for their sake he allowed. He wanted them to agree with him that Jesus has suffered enough. Pilate, however, was not ready for what happened next. Verses 6 through 9. When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" You can almost see Pilate standing there in total bewilderment. "What? Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. Talk about a satanic frenzy. The chief priests, the leaders, the officers of the temple cry out, "Crucify him." If anyone should have had pity on this man, it should be these leaders of one of the most oppressed nations of all time. But their hearts have no room for pity. They have no room for mercy. They have no room for compassion. And they have no room for the God who has been nothing short of gracious and compassionate and loving to a people who have rejected him from the beginning, always turning their hearts from him. But instead, their hearts are filled with raw evil. I mean, even Pilate, he's a Gentile. He has no history, you know, connecting to a God who loves. And he's more than willing to release Jesus. He's like, finished. He's like, "I'm done with this mess. Nothing more to do with your wickedness. You take him." Then for the third time, Pilate declared Jesus' innocence. Don't skip over that. Three times. The number three in biblical numerology represents divine completeness and perfection. So from the standard of divine perfection, Jesus is perfectly innocent. But when men are determined to do evil, they cannot even be reasoned with, and they just shout, "Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him!" Notice that when he said, "Behold the man," they clearly understood that Pilate was calling them out for their lack of compassion. They understood exactly what he meant. So they try and convince them that they're not there out of jealousy or some illegitimate reason. They're there for legal reasons, not out of hatred. They have a law. "We have a law." Now, this was clearly not Roman law, but it was Jewish law. They had come to Pilate accusing Jesus of sedition, of being a traitor against Rome, and now they're coming clean with their real accusation and the basis for which they condemn Jesus to die. He is a blasphemer. Obviously, this was no concern of Rome's. Zero. None. So you have to ask yourself, why would Pilate not choose to just release Jesus and maybe provide protection for him so he can get out of town? I mean, clearly he's alarmed. He's afraid deeply, especially when he hears that Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. So what kept this man from just letting Jesus go? I'm totally intrigued by Pilate and what was going on inside of him. His soul must have been absolutely tortured with this whole affair. As a Roman, Pilate would have worshipped many gods. But there was something unique about this discussion he was having with Jesus that absolutely unnerved him. And he couldn't shake the uneasy feeling. He remembers that Jesus said he was a king of an unseen realm. And now, this claim that he is the Son of God? He interviewed Jesus. He knows he's not crazy. But still, this was not normal. It's all messed up, and it's way out of control. Matthew 27:19 tells us that Pilate's wife actually had a dream the previous night and sent him a message saying, "Hey, have nothing to do with this holy man. I suffered greatly in a dream because of him." Pilate had read that message or received it. It's no wonder this guy is terribly afraid. Little side note, I think it's amazing how God was willing to have mercy on Pilate and warned him through a dream with the involvement of his wife about, you know, not participating in this unholy travesty. And this just highlights the justice of God the Father and the reality that no one will be able to claim innocence in their rejection of the Son of God. Everyone will have a chance. Everyone. Even Pilate. Verses 9 through 11. He, being Pilate, entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the authority to release you and the authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." Pilate once again retreats to this private chamber and takes Jesus with him. Jesus could probably barely stand at this point. And he says, "Where are you from?" Intriguing question. Pilate knows that Jesus is from Galilee. We find that in Luke 23:6, because he sent Jesus off to Herod to have Herod judge him. So he wasn't acting a practical question, but a rhetorical question. Where are you from? He's musing still about Jesus' claim to be both the King and the Son of God and was absolutely bewildered. Like many Romans, I'm sure that Pilate was very cynical about the gods, these gods that they worshiped, these stone idols that they bowed before. But here was a man who is claiming to be the Son of God standing right in front of him. A man who claimed to rule a kingdom not made of flesh and blood. And Jesus just stands there and doesn't say a thing. He stood silent. Could you imagine how creepy that must have been? Pilate's freaking out. "Where are you from? I have the authority to condemn you, to kill you. Talk to me." And Jesus just stares silently. Totally unnerving. But as the true king, he had spoken already. He didn't need to defend his position. And his words that he had spoken before stood alongside his silence as a testament to the truth that deep down Pilate suspected just might be true. Notice that Pilate automatically just resorts to the pride of his office and the pride of his position. The "me" in this statement is emphatic. "You will not speak to me? I am the big guy here." Then the next line is actually quite ironic. You see, Pilate may have the legal authority to release Jesus. He may have the legal authority to crucify Jesus. But you know what? The power to levy his own judgment was not in his hands at all. If he really had the power, he would have released Jesus before flogging him. He knew he was innocent. He would have continued with this debacle and once again be in another intense one-on-one with Jesus while everybody else is out there shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." Think about the paradox. This man is a governor of the entire region of Judea, a representative of the almighty Rome, backed by 4,000 or more soldiers, that is beck and call, who would follow every one of his orders. And yet 3 times now he has declared Jesus and announced him to everyone that he was innocent. And yet Jesus stands there bound in custody. See, Pilate was a man with all the formal authority, but little to no power. As Jesus said, Pilate's authority is being, and his power is being controlled from above. And see, this was all the Father's will. The brutality that Jesus suffered was his dad's design for his life. And the Father's will always prevails. Nothing could ever change it. No one could move his hand when he decides to act. And the Father is merely just using these wicked men to effect his will. And right now, they have their hands around Pilate's throat, and he knows it. He just doesn't know what to do about it. And they're about to squeeze tighter and pull out their final card in this treacherous game. And Pilate's about to understand how, and the extent to which he has been played. But before we move there, let's stop and consider how in the midst of this horrific process, Jesus never wavered. Once he made up his mind in the garden, he was resolute. And he did not for a moment trip over the what, as he fully understood the why. The what? It was horrific. They tore his body apart. They mocked him. They ridiculed him. They spat on him. They hit him. They marched him around in kingly attire. I mean, you would think that the scourging would have been enough. But then add to it all this abject humiliation. It was overkill. The what was ridiculous. It was beyond imagination. Yet Jesus kept his eyes on the why and was not moved by the gravity or the ridiculousness of his circumstances. He knew his Father was in control of everything and never for one moment internalized what was happening to him as if his Father was being mean to him, or as if his Father didn't love him or didn't care for him. He knew the truth and fixated on the truth. And this is a powerful lesson for us. Remember, Jesus said that he is our gatekeeper and the good shepherd of our lives, that he manages every detail and that it's all working for the good. But as we try and navigate the difficulties of life, we tend to take our eyes off the why. You know, the why being that he loves us and he wants us to learn how to trust ourselves to his love. And we get so misdirected by the what is happening around us. And I'm afraid that the what still has too much power and control over how we live. Right? As soon as our circumstances are somewhat ridiculous, what happens? Our emotions shoot up. They start telling us things that are totally out of whack. And then our expectations of God get all distorted and we can't line them up with the truth. And before we know it, we've lost sight of his love. We believe he is mean. We believe he is uncaring, uninterested, and even unloving. And this wrong belief leads to times of dark confusion, sadness, depression, and spiritual death. We need to follow Jesus' example and remember that if anything comes against us, whether it's circumstances or people, it's because the authority has been granted from above. And if our Father has allowed it, if we stare at the why, we can rest in his love. If we stare at the what, I guarantee you find yourself in. He loves you. He is your good shepherd. And he never lets anything happen unless he wants you to learn how to trust deeper and more fully in that love. Besides, we can also rest because we know that he's going to hold all those who are involved in hurting us responsible for their choices. Jesus told Pilate that although he's guilty of punishing an innocent man and he will be held to account, the religious leaders who saw the miracles, heard the teachings, and personally encountered him will be accountable for a far greater sin. And with greater knowledge comes greater accountability. And believe me, they will get their comeuppance. And this gives us another glimpse into the perfect justice of God. Besides, whenever I think that I have it bad, whenever I think that, you know, things are just not going well and I'm focusing on the what, God always tries me to push me back to what the writer of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 12, 4 through 6. And this becomes a little more vivid in our minds after just reading this story of what they did to Jesus. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. And he, what's the word he chose here? Scourges every son whom he receives. Interesting choice of words. You have not yet resisted the point of shedding blood. But the Father scourges every son. We have to try and encourage each other to remember that, like Jesus, we are sons of God. He's chosen each one of us, and we belong to the one who holds ultimate authority in his hands, the one to whom all creation bows. And he does not forget us. He does not take his eyes off of us, not even for a moment. And here's the thing. Even in his discipline, his love for us is perfect. Thus, he allows circumstances in our life to help train us how to believe him and how to trust in his love. Some of you are shut down even tonight as I'm talking. Struggling, frustrated. There's been plenty of times where I've been up here struggling, frustrated. We have to fixate on the why. He loves us, and he will always love us. And again, we need to encourage each other when we gather together, when we look at the faces and we see the pain, we see the struggle. We need to be encouraging each other to remind us that he loves us. And to encourage each other to be resolute in fixating on the why. And when you start to learn to do this, now this is a discipline. This is a choice. This is something that we have to do. To believe that God loves us in this way. It doesn't just instantly happen. We have to choose to say, okay, you know what? Yes, these what is horrible. I'm going to set it aside because his love is perfectly beautiful for me. And it never diminishes and never fades. And when I choose to set my mind on that, you know what? You're going to find that it will be beautiful and comforting. And you can endure any of the what's. That's why he tells us in Isaiah 40 that we can walk through fire and we won't get burned. We can walk through the water, the floods, and we won't be drowned. He will protect you. Let's go on. John 19:12. From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." I mean, Pilate is desperately trying to find a way out. But these religious leaders laid down their final card. This was the pinnacle of their cunning and their plan. They don't care about Caesar. They can't stand the guy. They're an oppressed nation. But they fully exposed just the depths of how detailed their planning was. And you know what? Pilate instantly knows that he must yield to their wicked game. For all of Pilate's, you know, power, he stands there, a conquered foe. What's fascinating, however, is that the weapon used to conquer this lifelong politician, this political strategist, was of all things, Roman politics. To understand this, we have to understand a little bit of the political history. See, even though Pilate was perhaps moved by Jesus at this point, he knew he was innocent. He wanted to see him released. He was searching for ways to find him, releasing him. And this notion of an unseen kingdom was fascinating. The reality of his life, his obligations, and mostly the threat of political demise ultimately outweighed any thoughts of eternity. Here's the rest of the story. Next to collecting taxes, perhaps the most critical job of a Roman governor was to establish and maintain what they call Roman peace, Pax Romana. See, this was paramount for successful occupation of foreign lands. Couldn't have any uprisings. They needed peace, and they used force to maintain the peace. Here's the thing. Pilate already had a few strikes against him in the eyes of Rome. And he knew that all it would take is one more crisis, one more outburst, one more riot. And he would likely be called to account by Caesar and could lose both his power and position. He reigned in Judea for just 10 years, from 26 to 36 BC. And he was known to be a cold-hearted, brutal ruler. A first century author named Philo of Alexandria described him this way. He was naturally inflexible, a blend of self-will and relentlessness, given to briberies, insults, robberies, outrages, and wanton injuries. Execution without trial, constantly repeated. Ceaseless and supremely grievous cruelty. Given that description, it should not surprise you to know that during the first year of his administration, Pilate brought Roman images into Jerusalem from his main headquarters in Caesarea. So his main headquarters was up in the Galilee area, up in Caesarea. And he brought these down, and it created total pandemonium amongst the Jews. His troops marched into Jerusalem, and of course he did it at night. But they had all their regimental standards, bearing medallions of the emperor's image. All the Roman symbols, the eagles, and all this came marching in. And because the emperor was worshipped as a god, these medallions were seen as graven images, expressly forbidden by Jewish law. And don't think for a minute that he was being naive. I mean, that's obviously why he brought these in at night. He knew exactly what he was doing. He wanted to firmly establish his rule and put a chokehold on these Jews. In so doing, he risked something that none ever dared to risk. They knew how crazy the Jews would become in matters of their religion. And so this move by Pilate resulted in a huge uproar and rioting. At one point, the Jews laid themselves all out on the floor by the soldiers, and they exposed their necks, claiming that they would rather die than have Jerusalem corrupted with idols. So after a lot of turbulence and a lot of dirty diplomacy, a lot of deals were made, Pilate relented, and he removed the images and returned them back to Caesarea. Then strike two occurred. Pilate was going to build an aqueduct to carry more water into Jerusalem. Good thing, right? His intent was purely to improve the city's water supply. But this led to an uproar and a total just chaos as well, because Pilate had raided the sacred coffers. He went and took money from the treasury to fund this building project. And since the aqueduct was fed from cisterns, well, it actually fed these cisterns that ran beneath the temple, all the guys of the priests who worked at the temple were going to have access to a lot more water, and it benefited the temple work. So he felt completely justified in taking money from the treasury to pay for this project. And Jewish law permitted the use of excess revenue for civic projects, so that wasn't the problem at all. It's just it did not permit Gentiles to walk into the inner part of the temple and steal their money, which Pilate did without remorse. Some accounts say that the religious leaders actually cut a deal with him and gave him the money and just warned him that the people might be in an uproar, you know, if he uses sacred money for this project. Well, whether they gave it to him or not, we don't know. But we do know is that people totally flipped out. So what did Pilate do? He had his soldiers dress up as Jews and circulate among the rioting crowds. And he gave them all daggers, and they were going around just stabbing people, killing people, slicing throats, cutting them, wounding them, and then beating them. And his soldiers went crazy. They totally lost control and went overboard. It says they were indiscriminate in their actions. They would just kill anyone, whether they were standing there watching or rioting. They were just killing people. And they attacked and attacked until the Jews relented. And once the protest was squelched, Pilate went ahead with this construction project. Victor, not knowing that they were keeping score. And then in 31 AD, just like about 2 years before Jesus stood before Pilate for judgment, Pilate placed some golden shields on the walls of the Praetorium in Jerusalem. They had no images, only dedicated inscriptions to the emperor. They said things about how great the emperor was. Tiberius was his name. And Pilate wanted to flatter him and display his loyalty after some failed coup where somebody tried to take Tiberius' life. But what happened? All levels of Jewish society freaked out. And unlike the earlier incident with the standards, Pilate refused to remove them. And although the shield bore no images, the Jews were incensed because They talk about a man who is honored as a god. So the Jews threatened to send a delegation to Rome. And And Pilate knew he couldn't have that. Okay? If they did go to Rome, they would also bring all this other accusations about his abusiveness, his savageness, his violence, and all the other things he did to them. And it's completely, as we've been told in the history books, that his entire administration was extremely anti-Semitic. They hated the Jews. And this is something he didn't want Caesar to know anything about. Now, we're told that the Jews never sent the delegation, but what they did do is they sent a letter to Caesar, you know, venting their full complaint. And we're told that although Tiberius was a very even-handed man, it said that he is not prone to anger. He rarely got upset. Then when he got this letter, he freaked on Pilate. He was so angry. They said that he didn't even wait to write a response. He did it right then, right at that moment, and wrote this response of rebuke and just chastising Pilate for his insolence and his audacity. He commanded Pilate to remove the images and return them to Caesarea. Pilate did as directed. So think about that. All these strikes are against him. The Jews have already shown that they are successful at moving Caesar's hand against him. Pilate knew that if the Jews would once again appeal to Rome, saying that someone had claimed to be a king and ordered people not to pay taxes, and Pilate did nothing about it, you know what? It would be his head. It does not matter if the charges were true or not. He knew that Tiberius was more than annoyed with his inability to effectively rule the Jews and preserve Roman peace. This is the reason why Pilate succumbed to their political ploy to coerce him to kill Jesus. He was trapped. It was literally Jesus' life or his own. He chose poorly. He chose his own. By the way, Pilate's fears were accurate. They were dead on. 3 years later, there was another matter of great turbulence in Samaria regarding some messianic hopeful. And after Pilate violently squelched that matter, the Samaritans appealed to his boss, the prefect of Syria. And sure enough, within short order, Pilate was called back to Rome to go be confronted by Caesar. There are many rumors about what actually happened after that. Some stories say that in his disgrace and humiliation, he committed suicide. And others, rumor that he became a Christian and was ultimately martyred for his faith. We don't really know what happened. The history books kind of cut off with him going to Rome. But we do know that the power and the cunning of the religious leaders was more than he had hoped. Oh, they played the political game so well. And by the way, in that same year that he was sent to Rome, the prefect of Syria also deposed Caiaphas and removed him from office. John 19, verses 13 through 16. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. We'll pick up with this passage next week, but I wanted to read it this week to focus, spend some time studying it, focus on the details that John included in just that little passage. They're all important, and we're not going to jump over any of them. But in closing, I also just want to make a note about, I know that it was a little intense, the story of Jesus' scourging and his beating and what he went through. And this is just the start. It gets worse. But I want you to think about the why. Okay? Why did he go through that? Because he loves you. Do you understand that each one of you were destined to eternity of that kind of suffering, that kind of terror, that kind of pain because of your sin? And yet he said, "No, I will do it. Do it to me, Dad. I will take it so they don't, because I love them." And now you and I spend eternity free from that kind of punishment. Eternity free. No condemnation, because he loves us. That's our why. And when we focus on that why, the whats we can handle. Yes, they're difficult. They're not easy. They're painful. They're horrific. But you know what? We can handle them. We can walk through resolute like Jesus did because of that why. He loves us so much. And it's the why that's to give us rest in our souls. That if he allows things, it's because he cares for us. And he wants us as a son to be disciplined, to be conformed into his image. So he can teach us how to believe him and why we can believe him and how to rest in his love. That's the whole point. Father, we just thank you that we can rest in the why, that you love us more than anything. And you gave your body for us, literally, in so many unbelievable ways so that we can be with you free, clean, clear conscience. And I thank you for that. You are an amazing God. Let these thoughts carry with us through this week. Let them wrap around us. And I love you so much in Jesus' name. Amen.